are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 11th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, but instead from some ballroom in the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, for the 2019 Mass Torts Conference Spring Version. On the program today, Julian Assange arrested, U.S. to seek extradition, and Bill Barr goes full Breitbart. Meanwhile, Sudanese dictator Omar al-Bashir ousted after peaceful protests. Is his next stop The Hague? There's a new Brexit deadline, Delexit.
Delexit
is October 31st. Scary. Starting to get the feeling that nobody wants to do that. Meanwhile, Treasury blows off Democratic deadline for Trump's taxes. Speaking of taxes, Republican tax bill works. Twice as many major corporations will pay no taxes this year. And lastly, New York City nurses threaten a strike and win big concessions, all this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, so I am in Las Vegas for the biannual Mass Torts Conference. We're going to be talking to attorneys who are working on consumer cases. We're going to be talking attorneys who are working, broadly speaking, in this space and about what the Trump administration is doing, largely through executive order, but also through executive agencies, to close the doors of the courthouses to citizens, narrow their opportunity to get any type of redress from corporations, and also head off the attempts of trial lawyers to function as a second-order regulatory scheme, I guess, for the private market. So we're going to be talking to all those folks. We're also going to be talking to some advocates for children and for people who have been trafficked and sexually abused. And they're going to be, and part of what we're going to be talking about is why they would be here, as they're working a two-track type of situation with legislation that's going on in states to states. We're going to talk to a couple of folks about that in a bit. I'm breaking the format that we normally have here for the most part because of the just extraordinary amount of news that's just broken in the past, like, literally 3 hours. And we're going to talk more about this later in the program. But Julian Assange was kicked out of the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK. He was then taken into custody. He was then very quickly tried and found guilty of skipping bail in Great Britain. And I think that carries a 12-month sentence, if I'm not mistaken. In the meantime, it was announced that the U.S. will be extraditing, or at least having a hearing to extradite Assange in about a month. Maybe it's May 15th. And to be clear, the only thing that we know that they are, the grounds in which they are seeking to extradite him, is based on a I'm not sure when the indictment actually happened, but it was the 2010 actions and his involvement in the leaks that Chelsea Manning essentially provided to WikiLeaks. If you will recall, those leaks included footage of U.S. helicopters, I believe, firing on Iraqi civilians.
Right.
In addition, it was a massive trove of defense and the Department of State cables from around the world. And I distinctly remember this because this got a lot of debate at the time, and I was doing a lot of MSNBC at the time, frankly. And the mainstream conventional wisdom was there was nothing that Chelsea Manning provided via WikiLeaks that had any import to the American public or to any country's public. And then, literally, every single day for the next 2 years, there was at least one story based upon, written by the press, based upon those leaks. So it was newsworthy enough that, and this is not an exaggeration, almost every single day there was a story that came out of it. Some of it was in the United States, some of it was around the world. And there was no indication that any U.S. interests were in any way inhibited or infringed upon by these leaks. There was some, I guess, diplomatic embarrassments that took place. Yet, as you know, Chelsea Manning went to prison. Her sentence was commuted to some extent after, frankly, she was treated horribly in prison.
She was tortured.
By President Obama. She is now, my understanding, in jail now for refusing to testify in the grand jury, to the grand jury that I presume is the grand jury that had at least this indictment. Now, I've heard, you know, when I'm in Vegas, obviously 3 hours behind on East Coast, I got to get up early, get here, have my complete meltdown about the technical issues that I anticipate setting up. And then so I've only had limited time to read into this. The reports I'm hearing on television, anyways, say that the indictment involves Julian Assange helping Chelsea Manning, then Bradley Manning, crack some type of DOD encryption so that Chelsea Manning could get this material. So far, however, from what I've seen of the indictment, and I will concede, I have not seen much, but there is a couple of elements of the indictment that are highly problematic. And putting aside what people think about Julian Assange as an individual or in the functioning of WikiLeaks in the election, people really need to compartmentalize these things, because this is when really bad precedents get set if you are not careful and can't separate the person and other activities they may have been involved with the specific activities that they're being prosecuted for. Right? I mean, Donald Trump, I would love to see him in shackles, but not for something that would, you know, not for the expansion of Social Security, let's say. And so one of the things, or at least two of the things in the indictment, number 19 and 20 of the indictment, it was part of the conspiracy, and to be clear here,
this
Assange
is in the
being,
manners and means of the conspiracy. This is page 5 of the indictment, just so people know where you're on.
It was part of the conspiracy that Assange and Manning took measures to conceal Manning as the source of the disclosure of classified records to WikiLeaks including by removing usernames from the disclosed information and deleting chat logs between Assange and Manning. There is not a single reporter in the country at any outlet, anywhere, that who gets leaks from government officials who would not have done that and has not done that.
What's their obligation to do that?
You'll recall that The Intercept failed to fully protect Reality Winner when she leaked the information that Russia had attempted to interfere in the elections, the 2016 elections, and she's now in prison for it. And The Intercept attempted to do as much as they could and didn't go quite far enough. 20, it was part of the conspiracy that Assange encouraged Manning to provide information and records from the departments and agencies of the United States. Undoubtedly, Chelsea Manning approaches WikiLeaks, has some information, and Assange says, yeah, get me more, which is also what every single reporter who has a source for leaks does. So these are very dangerous. Lastly, 21, it was part of the conspiracy that Assange and Manning used a special folder on a cloud Dropbox of WikiLeaks to transmit classified records containing information to the National Defense of the United States. These elements of the indictment are highly problematic. And it is crucial for people. That doesn't mean that there aren't elements of the indictments that may be legit, but it is crucial for people to speak out against this, because there are 20 whistleblowers, or we don't know, maybe 40, who have gone to the Democratic committees right now. There may be some who are going to reporters who are blowing the whistle on things that the Trump administration is doing. And every single one of those reporters have an obligation to protect their source and are doing exactly those three things that we just read from that.
Can I add just really quickly? I mean, that's to me, that's, you know, that's at least 90% of the story and why we need to object to this 100% regardless of what you think of Assange. And I do want to say the 25th on acts of furtherance of the conspiracy, where this is more about the specific, you know, password claim. And I'll just read 25th. On or about March 10th, 2010, Assange requested more information from Manning related to the password. Okay, that sounds at least more in line with what they're claiming. And then he indicated that he'd been trying. I don't know what indicated means, but has had no luck so far. So, like, the most explosive thing that they're putting forth, while obscuring the really dangerous substance, doesn't appear to have any real weight to it, at least from the indictment. And I just want to add briefly, too, like, you know, I'm very comfortable with, like, WikiLeaks of 2010 and 2011 are very different than 2016.
Right.
And even if you go, like, I was just doing stories on Haiti recently, and I had forgotten that, like, WikiLeaks was enormously helpful in exposing State Department, sweatshop lobbying in Haiti. I mean, this was a resource against U.S. civilian casualties and all sorts of corruption across the globe. And we really need to remember the value that they did provide, and also what this reflects, and I'll say it later about what's happening in Ecuador as well. So this is a big problem, regardless of what you think of Assange.
All right, and we will talk more about this as the show progresses. I just want to remind you, this episode of the Majority Report being supported in part by Simple Habit. It's a mobile app that provides massive and a diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally for free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for different parts of your day. Just about anything you might be dealing with in life, they have guided meditations for mindfulness, meditations for anxiety, depression, or when you're having trouble falling asleep. Hand raise. Meditations for when you're wanting to overcome procrastination or when you have something important going on at work. Meditations designed for parents, Fortunately, none for blackjack, or at least none that I have found so far. They have meditations made specifically for when you're waking up or your lunch break or when you've just gotten home from work, when you're going to bed. Different people are trying to attempt to do different things with meditation, and Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of their goals with meditation or how much past experience they have with meditation. The variety of guided meditations on Simple Habit is what sets it apart. They won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Well-Being App. It's available on iOS and Android and as a web-based service. Majority Report audience can try it for free for a week by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube or you're listening to the podcast, we will put it in the show descriptions, simplehabit.com/majority. Also, just a reminder, maybe you've had a long day at work, tough day at school, you're still stuck in the office, you can treat yourself to the meal you deserve. It's on demand from your favorite restaurant. Restaurants come to you with DoorDash. DoorDash connects you to all of your favorite restaurants in the city. Just use the DoorDash app to choose what you want to eat, and your Dasher will bring it right to you wherever you are. With over 310,000 other amazing restaurants in over 3,300 cities across the U.S. and Canada, DoorDash lets you order from your local go-tos as well as your favorite chains like Chipotle or Wendy's or Chick-fil-A and the Cheesecake Factory. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code MajorityReport. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code MajorityReport. Again, that's promo code MajorityReport for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. All right, we're going to get back to the news later in the program. But now I want to welcome to the show Bridie Farrell. She is from our neck of the woods up in New York State. And she is the founder of New York Loves Kids. Bridie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So, Bridie, tell us what New York Loves Kids is. What
we're all about?
What you're all about.
Yeah, of course. So New York Loves Kids, we started it about 2 years ago in response to the need to change the statute of limitations law for child sex abuse in New York State. And meaning a community in New York for 13 years, have been trying to pass legislation to improve the law. And we meet with lawmakers, and it wasn't moving it. And so what I said was we need to do something grassroots and local to get people aware of child sex abuse at large, and then hopefully that will push the law to eventually change. So we started the organization with a lofty goal of ending child sexual abuse, and we are well in business and have a lot of work left to do.
You're a survivor yourself.
Yes.
And I imagine, you know, the recovery process for that is rather long and difficult and maybe ongoing in many respects.
For sure.
How much of your experience do you think that is involved in moving this forward? I mean, because we also, you know, we've also sort of in the wake of a lot of horrific stories, particularly in terms of the U.S. gymnastic team. Mm-hmm. And your experience was also a function of
sports
as well. Yeah. Give us a sense of how that plays into moving the legislation.
For sure. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, when we're looking at legislation, when we're looking at politics, whatever it is, when we're looking at any sort of relationship, it comes down to the human stories. And so getting people like myself to come forward and tell the darkest days of our lives and our worst nightmares is really important. But I also recognize that it's a choice for me to come forward. So a lot of people ask, well, you know, why don't other people come as well? And I didn't choose to be sexually abused, so no one is being forced to speak as well. But I think obviously being through it, I have a unique perspective. I can talk about how the man that sexually abused me was trusted in our community. He was a four-time Olympian, an Olympic medal. He went on to be the president of USA Speed Skating, the chairman of the International Skating Union. He helped run the Salt Lake Olympic Committee with Mitt Romney. Like, it wasn't a sleazy man in a windowless van. Like, it was a very, very respected person. And to blow that myth off of what we're talking about of stranger danger ideas, that right. Unfortunately it's the people that, you know, come to Thanksgiving dinner or come to Little League or that kind of thing.
And I mean, I assume, did he have other victims? Or?
Yeah, so I am the fifth in the lineup.
Right.
There was actually, so this is pretty wild. I was abused by Andy Gable in 1997 and 1998. I was 15 and he was 33. There was a, I say police investigation, although it was a botched investigation done into him in 1990 when he was having sexual relations with a 14-year-old girl. That girl, her parents were never contacted. There was the investigation of the Marquette Police Department in Michigan never interviewed her or Mr. Gable, right? So there's documentation that the United States Olympic Committee, that U.S. Speed Skating, Northern Michigan University had on this person and let it keep going.
So,
I'm not the first.
I mean, how does an investigation like that start without the awareness of the parents?
Well, so in sports, a lot of times you leave your home and go live in a dorm. And so speed skating has been resident at Northern Michigan University's U.S. Olympic Education Center for a long time, no longer, but for a while. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in a speed skating mecca in Saratoga Springs. So I was able to go to my own high school and graduate. But most kids leave home at, you know, if you're good, 12, 14, 16. So you had a really, really talented skater living in with the national team at 14. And there's other sports that are in the dorms. And a boxer, someone from USA Boxing, would see this girl come out of Mr. Gable's room and be crying in the middle of the night. And they put a note on his door that says, do 14, serve 15. Like, it was known.
Wow. So, all right, tell us what the nature of, I mean, you've had a really, I mean, I got to imagine, like, this is sort of the goal of the organization that you started over a decade ago. And Governor Cuomo just signed this legislation a little less than 2 months ago.
Yeah, right.
Tell us about the legislation and sort of the, want to hear the backstory a little bit of how
right.
you get there.
Right.
But tell us about the legislation that he signed.
So we passed what's called the Child Victims Act in New York State. And going forward, what it does is the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse, so if you're abused under age 18, is age 28 for criminal. So you have to go to the police report by age 28. And for civil, going forward, it's age 55, which is amazing.
All right. What were they up until?
23.
23 for both?
Both.
So
the average age that a survivor speaks is 42.
Jeez.
So it's, I mean, I don't, you got to leave the emotions out of it and look at it from like a economic perspective. So yeah, it's insulting, but that's irrelevant. It's ineffective. 23 is ineffective, right?
Well, it also, I think, I mean, not only is it ineffective in terms of redress for the survivor of abuse, but it also, I would imagine, has a cultural impact mm-hmm. to say, like, why can't you, like, it completely underestimates the level of trauma mm-hmm. and misunderstands how it is processed.
Right.
By a child in
right.
particular. Never
right.
mind. I mean, I think there's a similar dynamic, obviously, for an adult, but mm-hmm. but by a child. I mean, it's sort of extraordinary.
Well, yeah, so that's exactly it. And I mean, I came public with my story 6 years ago when I made a comeback to speed skating. And then I've been talking about this and kind of yelling into the wind and, you know, nothing really happened. And then Me Too happened, right? And there were two pivotal points in Me Too for me. First was Kevin Spacey. So Kevin Spacey picked up a 14-year-old boy at a party, carried him into a room, and laid the boy on a bed and laid on top of him. The boy was able to, like, squirm, kick, whatever, get out of there, and no additional contact was made. But within a day, like, House of Cards was rewritten. Like, the guy was out.
Right.
He fell. because he laid on top of a boy. So it was, society's like, yeah, a grown man, I think Mr. Spacey was like in his 30s, can't lay on top of a juvenile, 14-year-old, right? And I remember being like, what the hell? Like, Andy Gable admitted in the Chicago Tribune this inappropriate relationship, and there's no recourse. And not that I really want him to go down, but he can walk in and coach any kid's soccer team. He can walk in and be a teacher. So there was that. And then the second part was Matt Lauer and how Mr. Lauer, you know, inappropriately treated women or a specific woman in his workplace. And there was this man that came forward and said that he was intimidated. This coworker was intimidated and scared and nervous to speak up against what Mr. Lauer was doing. And that one, I was like, whoa, guys, stop. Like, we're going to recognize this man that's not, like, impacted in the situation at all, is too intimidated to speak up, yet we want a kid to speak up?
Right.
It's like, come on.
And did that resonate with people? I mean,
point it out, people are like, well, yeah, it's a good point. Or, like, I testified in front of Congress and, you know, with survivors of Larry Nassar, and they're like, you're so brave, you're this, you're that. And I was like, well, if you think I'm brave at 37 for talking about something 20 years ago, how do you expect a kid to do it? Like, recognize your own hypocrisy, not stop trying to, like, flatter me and, like, fix the problem, you know?
Right.
So.
Do you think there is a, do you think there's even, like a deeper understanding of the processing that goes around? I mean, because there's something obviously super gendered about what you're talking about,
for
right?
Sure.
Where the idea of, well, this is a 14-year-old boy that's getting assaulted, or you know, like you say, he intimidated another man at the work place as opposed to the
actual
victims.
Right.
Do you think that there that coming out of Me Too, that there is just a, that it's like blunt force on some level, or do you think that there is a greater understanding, or is there a little bit of mix of both?
Definitely both. And I think the blunt force is for the, I mean, quite honestly, like people like my dad, right? He's, I don't know how old he is, 70, 75-year-old white man, right? And I remember a couple years ago, we were home for Christmas, and he's like, I don't think all this like sexual abuse, sexual harassment stuff is real. So I was upstate in New York, and I was like, all right, my New Year's resolution is to keep a journal and write down all these things that happened in New York City, right? Well, my birthday is January 7th, and on my birthday, I was like, screw that. Like, this is too much. Because you just walk down the street in, like, you know, a Michelin jacket, puffy coat in New York City in January, and you get catcalled, and you get whistled, and you're, you know, you get slapped or whatever. Like, so someone like my dad, who has the best of intentions, just doesn't see it. You know, someone like Biden puts his hand around an 8-year-old boy last week and says he said it's okay. It's like, no, he's an 8-year-old boy. Like, that's not okay, right? So that blunt force part, with good intention, you know, that are trying to understand it. So I think that the inundation of women coming forward and being like, not okay, not okay, not okay, not okay, is when a lot of people are like, whoa, okay, maybe this is like really a thing.
All right, so in New York State,
mm-hmm.
It is now...
So wait, we missed one major part of the law.
Please.
The biggest part of the law, the most controversial part, is that, so for 1 year or 18 months, basically, survivors like myself can come forward and file civil suit retroactively. And
right,
that's...
I'm sorry, explain that again.
So anyone who was previously abused in New York State can file a civil suit against their abusers and the institutions that covered it up. And that's why the bill didn't pass.
So, so to be clear, we're going forward. So any abuse that takes place now
mm-hmm.
has a new statute
Correct.
Of limitations. But abuse that has happened in the past
yep.
is still constrained by the 23-year-old.
For criminal.
And for civil?
Civil, you have until anyone who is sexually abused in New York State has until August 2020 to file a civil claim.
I see. Okay. So for civil, there's a year, there's like a sort of a grandfather
yeah.
year type of, okay.
Right.
And
that's where we ran into the issues, because the Catholic Church was the number one opposition. The ultra-Orthodox Jewish community was third, and Boy Scouts of America was
wow.
the third.
Okay. And because there's a lot of people
right.
who, and they're going to come back in. And so when we talk about like why you're here.
Right.
is because you're talking to civil, you're talking to civil litigators, mm-hmm. trial lawyers, mm-hmm. who are in a position to bring those cases,
yep.
not just going forward, but in the next 12 months in
right.
New York State.
Right, right, right.
And it's also to let them know, because this is a state-by-state
legislation. State-by-state effort, right.
So, and what are the implications of that? I mean, it's basically just like, here's an opportunity for you to provide redress mm-hmm. for these people. And I would imagine it's not just a question of getting money, although, I imagine, like, there's a lot of therapy bills. There's a few,
yes.
But I imagine it's about, like, getting some official
right.
recognition,
acknowledgement. Acknowledgement, like, hey, this happened. And my goal now is to be a resource for any survivor that's looking for representation to call me and for me to try and help them connect them with someone that's in alignment with their goals and what they want to achieve. And then the second is, for folks that were abused, like a good friend and advocate, Mary Ellen, was abused by her stepfather, who wreaked havoc on her family. And he lives in he's poor and lives in a trailer park in upstate New York. He has no money, but she wants a $10 check from this guy. But no attorney's going to take that case.
Right.
So what I'm trying to do is find the attorneys that will have like a pro bono aspect to just be able to take this woman into the court of law and stand across from this guy that, you know, through such a wrench in her life. I don't want to say ruined it because, you know, we've
right.
recovered, had good lives. But there's two aspects. One, for the people like me that might have a case to not be taken advantage of. And then two, those that don't have a financial case that recognize we're not after some financial amount. It's the recognition or the disclosure of information, or saying someone that comes forward and says, this guy Joe did this to me 40 years ago. Well, that makes someone else say, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, that makes some kid be like, it's still happening. And that's when you can turn it over into the criminal, where I don't think like our legal systems of criminal and civil are silos, but they need to work together. And so the civil investigations will help the criminal cause.
Interesting. Well, Bridie Farrell, the organization is New York Loves Kids. And I imagine now you're starting to think about how you expand this and take this to other states.
That's exactly it. I was really focused on just New York because, sure, that's where my abuse happened. I grew up in New York, all that stuff. But more because New York, the political system in New York is an interesting one. And if you can do it there, you can do it anywhere kind of thing.
Right.
And so to have a solid law pass in New York, which we did when Andrea Stewart-Cousins came in to lead the Senate, and then looking across the country and be like, where are they protecting pedophiles over kids? And we'll go in there and help survivors regain that voice.
Did this law pass basically because the IDC
yes.
was destroyed? And
okay, so 13 years we tried to, I've been involved for 5 or 6, but people have been trying to pass this law. It was never voted on. It was never brought to a vote. Senator John Flanagan would not bring it to a vote.
Wow.
I've met with nearly every member of the legislature. He wouldn't meet with anyone. He wouldn't meet with a survivor from his own district.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, and folks can go to, what's the website?
NYLovesKids.org.
NYLovesKids.org. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
All right, folks. And joining me now is going to be Dr. Brooke Bello.
Yeah, Bello, like molto bello, Italiano.
Molto bello. And she is the founder of More to Life.
More to Life,
T-O-O. And tell us about this organization.
More to Life is an international award-winning anti-human trafficking sexual violence prevention agency with headquarters in Sarasota. We do work around the world, and we have 4 offices throughout Florida. We're also known for restorative justice, reduced demand education, which is court-appointed courses for those who violate purchase. Individuals have to go through our course and so on. And we work with victims from age 5 years old and up. And finally, we're a part of something that the Attorney General Pam Bondi approved a couple years ago, the Open Doors Outreach Network. So we work in 32 counties with a network.
And so, all right, so your organization does a lot of stuff.
Absolutely. And I do a lot of stuff as a Google Next Gen leader. There's a lot of stuff that we do related to tech, related to litigation and law, related to legislation. So,
what are the you're here at a conference full of trial lawyers. What is your the story that you're going to tell them?
I have three sessions and a book signing. The first session is with Geoff Rogers and Kevin Malone. Kevin Malone is former general manager of the Dodgers. He's a man of honor. And I think when you think of mass torts, you think of negligence, you think of strict liability, and you think of intentional negligence. And so in the era of human trafficking and all of the root causes, all of those things play a part. So we're going to talk about the false necessity bill, which has a lot of ramifications related to lawsuits now based on strict liability or negligence. We're going to talk about reducing demand since men are over 90% of the purchasers. And the United States is the world's largest producer of child porn. How to mitigate those issues on the internet, because 60% of kids are violated through the internet. And I love technology, but the iterations of tech have made it easier for children to be kidnapped or to be taken, more fraud, and now more litigation. And so the work today through this conference is to share that. And then finally, for the women, it's going to be a motivational talk. I'm going to share my story as a survivor of human trafficking as a child. And it's going to be a great 4 days.
I want to touch on your your personal story.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you about FOSS NECESTA, because it's a pretty controversial law, it seems,
right,
from the perspective of people who are advocates for human trafficking victims
and the prevention of it. Yes.
Because, I mean, just lay out what the controversy is and then weigh in on that for us.
Right. Your name's Sam, right?
Yes.
So, Sam, thank you for having me this morning in Las Vegas. I as a part of World We, signed on to the legislative bill, but I think there needs to be amendments because it was the only way to see it through. But I don't believe we can legislate our way out of human trafficking, and I also don't believe that it's really good to necessarily sue companies like Salesforce or Google or Facebook. It really depends, because the iterations of tech were so fast. Proving negligence, I think, is difficult. I think that has to happen in schools with prevention, but when we think of the Communications Decency Act, right, we think that online sort of companies were immune, but now they're not based on FOSS NECESTA, which is a positive, but with net neutrality rolling back in the future of work, it's going to inhibit our ability to be online affordably in the future. And so I think we have to sit down with big tech, like Google, like Facebook, and talk about prevention and disclaimers and safe use, rather than make it able for them to sue, because to prove that they understood or knew is hard, and it
right.
wastes money on the side of nonprofits that have to go into court. It also wastes money on the side of big tech. And so I think that bill, which I'm for, also needs some amendments.
What of the argument that in preventing, in the prevention of advertising
right.
For sex workers, that it prevents... It prevents advocates for trafficking victims for actually, like, tracking down those victims. Like, this will sort of make it that the...
It does, Sam. I see what you're saying. It really has a way of sometimes inhibiting our propensity or ability to locate victims
yes.
in addition to their traffickers and purchasers, because now they're going underground. And rings can become stronger. This is true. I think that, you know, our new app, Coming Home, kind of mitigates that globally, because victims always have a place to be able to reach out and get resources and help. That's why I think the bill needs to be amended. And we actually have to sit down with Big Tech. I was in Venice Beach last week at Google, and we had some really great speakers. We're there at Google to learn how to solve the world's problems through tech. And in that sense, we're able to, you know, ask questions and say how we feel. I think that if we're able to sit down, because they're already 20 years ahead. You know, we're talking about AI and VR and how it affects human trafficking, how it affects, you know, social problems, how it affects poverty. And most people don't even have a VR set in their house. And Silicon Valley and tech is past where that is. They're 30 years in the future. And so we're not going to legislate and sue our way out of the mess and the violence of human trafficking. And like you said, Sam, it's going to make it so hard. Because traffickers, you're talking about a global $970 billion business when you think of labor trafficking, domestic servitude, when you think of sex trafficking. And traffickers are wise, smart, because it's all about money.
Right.
And so, yeah, we have to sit down with big tech and we have to work together. That's what I believe.
And so you don't have the worry that some in your community have expressed in terms of how difficult it'll make to help those folks. I mean, because and maybe we can dovetail this in with your experience, but my sense is from what I've read and talking to sex workers or talking to advocates of people who have been trafficked or are being trafficked, is that the victims of trafficking in many instances aren't aware of where they can reach out for help, and or they're in a position that inhibits them from reaching out for help in some other ways. Is that, I mean, talk about your experience and why you think that the problem of providing like almost some like public face that provides leads for sex trafficking advocates, or I should say advocates of victims of sex trafficking, to help locate where that's going on is not as much of a problem. Does that make sense?
That was a really long question.
Yeah, I'm
not
sorry
sure
about
it
that.
Really makes sense.
Well, okay. All right. So
simplify it.
Well, I mean, the biggest complaint that I've heard about Sesta Fosta is that it's going to really basically pull the shades down and make it impossible for people outside of these networks of sex trafficking to see into that world and help victims of sex trafficking.
Right. And, so,
And your response is like, you know, your organization has created an app so that people can, that victims can reach, can come towards you. I wonder
right.
if there isn't a problem with the ability of people outside of that world to go to them.
I've been doing this work coming from being a champion, which is a survivor, and then an actor, and then crashing and burning in Hollywood, realizing there was something really wrong because I was a child when it happened. And so technically, I've been doing this work. My organization started 15 years ago. I've been doing this work for 18 years. And those of us who are strong advocates have the propensity and ability to teach and train others how to identify victims in plain sight. And the idea that victims don't know that they're victims. One of the key things, if we galvanize the issue of the United States foster care system in terms of the United States, right? 70% of kids in foster care have been trafficked. That is a State
wow.
Department or DOJ stat. The high propensity of homeless youth at 75% are exposed to human trafficking. And so I think, you know, 65% of black girls in our country are raped or trafficked. 30% of all girls in our country are raped or trafficked. And so if we deal with root causes first and prevention, it's going to be a lot easier to end and reduce human trafficking. In terms of legislative processes that inhibit someone's ability to identify, that is the crux and the quandary of the internet and online processes moving so fast that no one really understood how global it was going to be. Warren Buffett talked about it, you know, in the early 90s. The internet's not going to be a big deal. It's going to pass away, but we're far past that. And so if we deal with the root causes, we're going to be able to prevent victims. And while preventing them, we're going to find them. And we have to state that 92% of adult prostituted persons, male and female, were sex trafficking victims under federal or state law. And so when we deal with that issue, One of the other ways is never, ever, ever should we legalize prostitution here in the United States like they did in Germany. They thought it was going to end sex trafficking of kids. It did not. The prime minister came out and said, oh, my God, I thought it would lessen the sex trafficking of children, but the numbers are higher. And so, like I said, the false assessment bill needs to be amended. We need to work with big tech. We need to find safe use of the Internet. Kids see 200,000 violent images by the time they're 18. They see gonzo pornographic images of women being choked and punched and graphic sexual acts. And so in human development, we're sort of grooming kids through online processes to be hardened to the violence of human trafficking. And so if we do that, we won't have as much of a problem later. It's not perfect. It really is a big world kind of tsunami. And finally, you know, Sam, according to the Center of Disease Control, it's the worst violence that can happen to a child. And I know that. Like, I'm here with you now as an absolute miracle. I should not be here talking to you. I was near death a lot of times. And then I'm in my right mind, which also took years of therapy and so much that victims need to transform. And so we have to, find a way to work together.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Before I became an actor, actor John Voight was my first mentor. And I met him post human trafficking after I was rescued. I was brutally raped at 11, like a lot of girls in our nation and a lot of boys. There are a lot of trafficked boys in our nation. There were boys in the brothel that I was. There were girls younger than me. Eventually, I was traded around and eventually was rescued. And I was a straight-A student. I was a baseball player. I was one of the first girls in California to pitch and play baseball. I had my picture in the paper. I was, like, really athletic, and I was a young science buff. We were not a poor family. I ran away from home and a nice couple, my best girlfriend, I ran away from home. And Sam, this nice couple said, oh, you know, you guys look lost. We help kids like you. And we were not street savvy. We were kind of bookworms, athletic, geeky little, really pretty little girls. And we're like, okay. And we were actually on a track somewhere in the United States that we didn't really realize. And there were some adult prostitute persons that, like, bought us a hot dog or something. And we're really scared. And we really wanted to go home. But our parents didn't. They thought we ran away. So when I called Mom, you know, she just started screaming and yelling. And you're going to get in trouble. And the cops are going to come after you. You ran away. And I didn't know how to tell her what happened to me. So this nice couple, okay, turned out to be, like, the devil's advocate, like, really evil. So they took us out to eat. And they said, okay, last stop, we're going to go back to our place, get you some clothes and get you settled and figure out a shelter and maybe talk to your parents and get you back home. When we got into their place, they separated me from my friend. So I don't know what happened to her, but they beat me within an inch of my life, put drugs in me. And later that night, they were selling me, and my whole life changed after that. So I was addicted to drugs, and it was really the only buffer that I was a virgin as well, and men purchased me, and not one man asked for my ID. No, these men looked like, you know, my best friends, like dads, and they just thought that I was wanted to be there. And so I was in a room. There were 15 men in the room, being passed around the room, being repeatedly raped. And that is, you know, just a small part of my story and the story of so many other survivors and victims we work with. And I think one of the most profound things when I think of the Kavanaugh case, or I think of, gymnast, when people say, why don't girls tell? Why don't victims tell? Why don't boys tell? Because when you're young in human development, you think that the bad things that happen to you and around you are your fault. You think it's your fault when your parents divorce, let alone when you're raped. And that's what they drill into you. And we become what we see over time. And so I, too, thought it was my fault. And then I met John Voight. He ended up taking me to Whoopi Goldberg's house. I was really shocked, and I tried to sort of fake my way into nothing ever bad happened to me. And then in Hollywood, on sets, I would sort of have triggers and crash and burn. And actually, that's not a place at first to make a ton of money as an actor, as I did, because the exposure to drugs and sex and the inability to say no and not knowing who I was really affected who I am. And so I kind of galvanized some faith in God, I think, and I know for sure, and moved away, bought a house, and started more to life.
Oh, wow.
And then the journey of healing began, which too long of a story to tell you now.
I'm sorry for what you went through, and that's
thank you, Sam.
Incredible.
And I'm part Jewish, you know, black and Czechoslovakian Jew, and I think that the issues of bigotry in our nation, racial issues, criminal justice, from all of these things, when I was sold from Vegas to New York to L.A., and I'm in Vegas now, they call me Little Muyan. And so I was sold because of the color of my skin. And there were other little girls that were sold because they had blonde hair and blue eyes. And it was racially, and they always got more money for girls that were blonde hair, blue eye, and then me next. And so depending on that, there was racism even within human trafficking. And so it's just, you know, as a registered independent, we really have to come together. I had this conversation with Joshua Dubois, with some of the individuals from the Ways and Means Committee recently. We have to come together across party lines to combat and prevent this issue.
What is your ask, or what are you hoping to get from these trial lawyers here?
I think one thing is a lot of pro bono support for our survivors. The other thing is there are a ton, there are actually more men here at this conference. The women are outnumbered. And I love that because it's rare that I can walk into a room as a champion for human trafficking and see a room full of men. And all of my work deals with mentoring male youth and working with men in prevention. I'm not a feminist. I'm actually an equalist. And I think in order to drive this issue home, we have to talk about the legacy of fatherhood. We have to talk and get men outside of the man box, what Tony Porter talks about, or Eric Thomas speaks about, or Anthony Robbins, you know, speaks about. Men have to hold one another accountable to the harms of violent pornography. They have to hold one accountable that prostitution is illegal, to purchase individuals for sex is wrong, and bachelor parties who allow stripping and things like that that sort of have a gender disrespect. We have to discuss that because in today's world, most young boys don't want to get married. They want to hook up and have sex in the bathroom with a girl that barely knows who she is. So there's more, you know, STDs. There's more unwanted pregnancies. And if you look at our world, Sam, in 50 years, with marriage not being respected, no family structure, people not really respecting one another and loving one another or not believing that love is possible, imagine our world. So I want to get out of them support and understanding that they are the answer to the problem.
Well, Dr. Brooke Bello, the organization is More to Life, T-O-O, Life. Where can people get more information on this?
Absolutely. Our Twitter handle is at R-E-A-L, Real More to Life, T-O-O, and our website is M-O-R-E-T-O-O, life.org, and you can always find me at Brooke Bello, B-R-O-O-K, Be Like Boy, E-L-L-O.com.
Thank you so much for your time today. Really
thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to move on. And thank you. We're going to be talking to an attorney in a moment. We're taking a photo. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Oh, thanks. Yeah, we're still live now, so it's okay. All right, we're going to continue on. That was it's quite an amazing journey she has been on. But now we're going to change the pace a little bit, talk about some consumer litigation, I guess this would fall into. Troy Bauck.
Yeah, Troy Bauck with Love and Papantonio
is joining me. And Troy, you're working on a case, and this is a little bit of I should just, you know, tell our audience, there's a lot of we're dancing around here a little bit in terms
sure.
of going from topic to topic. This one, not quite as dramatic in some respects, but it is more aligned, I think, more typical of what we see in cases that we're talking about at this conference, dealing with really what I think probably constitutes corporate malfeasance to some degree.
Yeah, that's right, Sam.
Tell me, this is a case about 3M earplugs.
Correct. Yeah, 3M. Basically, the case originated when a company called Moldex out of California brought a QI-TAM action. And a QI-TAM action is like a whistleblower suit against 3M. And in the...
QI-TAM, just to be clear, is specifically deals with fraud that has been committed against the U.S. government. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so there is... And just explain to us, because there's actually sort of, I guess, private whistleblowers are incentivized to blow the whistle on private entities that are defrauding the U.S. government, and they get a portion of the recovery. Is that?
That's correct. Okay. That is correct, Sam. And in this case, the company that actually was a competitor to 3M discovered some evidence that 3M had allegedly, and their predecessor, Aero Technologies, had falsified some of the original testing of the Combat Arms version 2 earplugs that they were selling to the U.S. military. And so they took that information, filed a QI-TAM suit. And
now, how does a competitor find out that their competitor basically committed fraud in terms of testing these things? And
well, that's a really interesting story, Sam, because in this case, 3M is quite litigious, and they want to protect their market share for earplugs. And so what they did was they brought a suit against Moldex out of California, because Moldex had a competing brand of earplugs that was competing with 3M and Aero Technologies Combat Arms version 2 earplugs. And when I say 3M Aero Technologies, the reason why I'm saying those two companies together is because in 2007 3M bought out Aero Technologies. And okay. So Aero Technologies was the company that originally invented that Combat Arms version 2 earplug. So you have Moldex was out there. They were going to start marketing to the military and had started marketing to the military. So 3M filed a lawsuit against Moldex saying, hey, you guys are infringing on our patent. And so I don't know what they were thinking at the time, but it later turned out that, in fact, Moldex wasn't infringing on their patent at all. It almost appeared to be malicious prosecution, and that's in fact what Moldex had brought a charge or a claim against 3M, saying, hey, you know, we don't believe we're infringing. In fact, you guys are trying to maliciously prosecute us to keep us from selling our earplugs. And so when that was pending, they started doing some depositions. And during those depositions of that initial lawsuit, they started discovering, hey, wait a minute here. Something's not right. You know, when we look at 3M, you know, Aero Technologies Combat Arms earplug, it doesn't look like it was ever tested properly. What they were alleging is that ANSI standards requires that you meet certain specifications for testing. Well, 3M only tested it on 8 people, even though they were going to sell it later to millions of them to the soldiers. They only tested on 8 people. And it turns out that those 8 people were soldiers. I mean, not soldiers. I'm sorry. They were employees of 3M. So it even looked stranger. Like, why not farm it out to an independent lab to test their earplugs and have people that aren't employees of 3M or Aero Technologies just, you know, so it's sort of an independent test. But they didn't test it independently. They instead ran it through their own lab. When they didn't get the results that they wanted, they stopped the testing. But the allegation was is that they certified it as being as meeting the specs that the military wanted. And so, and the military ended up buying them. And so they purchased millions of them from 2003 all the way through to 2015.
Wow.
And those millions got assigned to basically every service member going through basic training in the U.S. Also, if you were in Iraq or Afghanistan, you were also being issued these combat arms earplugs.
So these earplugs are theoretical. I mean, I presume are so that when they're firing their arms, obviously, it's incredibly
right.
loud. We all see images of people at a range wearing major head gear
sets.
And obviously, you can't do that in combat in the
right.
same fashion. So that's pretty stunning. I mean, I there were a lot of stories of, if I remember correctly, particularly during the Iraq War, of suppliers of military gear that were cutting corners. Some instances, I think there were stories about Kevlar vests. And so is so for 12 years, 3M is selling these earplugs based to literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of, I mean, I guess hundreds of thousands of combat, of people who are either in combat or in training, which presumably is just as problematic.
Correct.
Having tested it on eight employees. So, and in what circumstances were these tests? Just like in... out in the backyard of the 3M plant?
You know, and that's what we don't know yet, Sam. We don't know if it was done in sort of a room in one of the offices at 3M or Aero Technologies. We simply don't know. And the reason why we don't know is that all the documents in that initial litigation have been sealed. And so we've just got bits and pieces. And so, but what we do know, however, and there's no mistake about it, is that 3M ended up paying $9.1 million to settle that QI-TAM action.
Okay, and so who is the plaintiffs in this situation? Like, who are your clients?
The plaintiffs are service members who served in the military in various branches between 2003 and 2015 and actually used the Combat Arms version 2 earplug. And you might think, well, how would they honestly know what earplug they were using? Well, the earplug itself is such a unique-looking earplug that it's really unmistakable. It's the only earplug that's double-ended, dual-ended. One half of the earplug is yellow. The other half is olive green. Some people describe it as black, but it's actually an olive green color. And it's very short. And it's made for you stick the yellow end in. If you are going to basically be out on patrol and you want to hear someone sneaking up behind you, that's the end with the little hole that runs down the center. Or you stick the green end in if you're, let's say, being transported in a helicopter to a different part of the desert. And so, because that end is what they call steady state, so it's going to protect against that constant noise, or it's supposed to protect against that constant noise. But what we see statistically is that during that same period of time, the number of service members that have got hearing loss or tinnitus has just escalated astronomically, right?
And tinnitus is when you have like a ringing in your ear, right?
Yeah. If you think about it, in the old days where you would listen to a record and after the song stopped playing, you'd make that sort of scratchy noise. And that's that sort of ringing or scratchy noise that just doesn't stop.
Is it tinnitus or tinnitus? Well,
you know, and that's a good question, because I think the actual pronunciation is tinnitus, but almost universally people pronounce it as okay. tinnitus, right? So we use it interchangeably.
And how did, if this is all sealed, how did, tell me the process of what happens here. So you get wind that there's a QI-TAM case. You don't know the details, but you see the broad outlines.
Yeah, and that's a good question, Sam, because in July 2018, the Department of Justice, they issue a press release. And the press release was, you know, about a page and a half, and it really outlined sort of the overall gist of, hey, you know what? we are, you know, we intervened in this case. We're going to protect our military service members. This shouldn't be happening. And they basically listed all the allegations that we're now pursuing. And as a result of that, the government, you know, had 3M pay $9.1 million. So
that doesn't seem like very much, to be honest with you. I mean, how much money did they make off of these?
It is not very much. And we see that over and over.
Do you know how much?
I honestly don't, because, we haven't been able to get the documents yet. We have to go through the whole legal process, get into discovery. We're going to ask to see all of those things, and then we'll have a better idea later on.
I got to imagine a contract to provide those amount of earplugs for 15 years has got to dwarf $9 million. I mean, it sounds to me like this is just like the cost of doing business for them. I mean, it just sounds like it's part of their overhead.
Yeah, and in fact, it probably did. You know, it'll be really interesting when we see how much they did make selling these defective or allegedly defective earplugs to the military. And but it's also equally interesting to me to see how many of our service members actually still have these Combat Arms version 2 earplugs just stuffed away in their possessions at home. And so they've been bringing them in to us and say, yeah, these are the ones I wore. And because at the time, the military, they issued a little plastic box, and the little plastic box attached to your sort of lapel on your shirt, and it was meant to put your earplugs in when you weren't using them, right? So they're always available to you, and that basically kept them together, and it's working out.
Do you know how many military potential like clients there are? I mean, do you have a sense of what the numbers are of military personnel who are using these devices ostensibly to protect their ears? And
well, we think the potential pool could be up to 1.5 million service members. It's a lot of people, because when you think about it, there were a lot of troops placed in Iraq and Afghanistan during that period of time, and there was a big surge. And so all those service members over there and back in our own country were all issued these earplugs.
Wow. So what are the next steps? You're going through the documents. You're trying to establish some of these facts.
Yeah.
How do you access those documents that have been sealed in a case like this QTAM case?
Well, this past week, the latest news was that the JPML, the sort of panel of federal judges that decide where the litigation, this mass tort litigation, is going to be situated, they chose Pensacola, Florida, the home of Levin Papantonio, our firm. And so
that's going to make you pretty happy. You're not going to be traveling so much.
It makes us very happy. You know, we've got a great judge, Judge Rogers. But the MDL just got formed, so we are going to have, you know,
MDL is the multi-district litigation.
That's correct. Okay. Yeah. And basically, it's not just going to be our firm, it's going to be many firms working together to pursue this case on behalf of the American service members.
We just explained the dynamics of a multi-district litigation. It just basically means that the case that you're bringing in, and this is a federal case out of a federal court.
Correct.
In Pensacola, there may be cases in Pennsylvania, there may be cases in Ohio, in probably every state in the country, and they're just going to be rolled up into this one case.
Yeah, and they do that for judicial efficiency, because as you can imagine, if there were 100,000 cases all over the United States, and each judge in those cases had to decide the same issues, you know, you might as well have one judge deciding the issues for everybody's case, regardless of where in the U.S. they're situated. So they group them together in what's called an MDL, and basically a leadership group will be formed from all the different plaintiffs' attorneys, and the judge will pick who's in that leadership group. And it'll obviously be very seasoned attorneys that have done this many, many times. And as the litigation progresses, we will go through the discovery stage that we were talking about earlier, where we'll get to take depositions. And we will, at some point, ask to see those documents that are currently sealed in that other litigation.
Well, Troy Boyk, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And is there a site? I mean, if there are vets listening, or I guess active service, I mean, we're talking 2015.
Yeah, if anyone's interested in the case, you know, they can always look at our site for 11 Papantonio, which is, you know, levinlaw.com. And we have one of the web pages on there deals with this litigation.
Troy, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Sam. Thank you.
All right, folks. I think we're probably going to take a break and head into the fun half. Obviously, quite a mix of what we had today. Tomorrow on the program, don't know. Basically, what I do is I go out and talk to different attorneys and see what cases might have, you know, some broader policy implications, or give a better understanding of the corporate mindset. I mean, the idea that we could have a private rating agency that would rate the quality of earplugs that 3M is presenting, you know, and or that, hey, look, U.S. government should learn their lesson 15 years later not to buy the earplugs from 3M. I mean, the reason why I keep coming back to this conference is not merely to lose money at the blackjack table or at the craps table. But it is because you can see the depths of corporate malfeasance here. These are the people who professionally expose it, dig through it. Every time I talk to an attorney here, the idea that we need severe regulation on corporations in a myriad of ways is reinforced. Also, the function that these lawyers play in our society is when you are in, and frankly, you know, it's during the Obama administration, obviously was much better on this than the Trump administration, but still highly problematic. When you're in an era where there is a sense that we need to deregulate corporations, these trial lawyers end up being a second sort of order bulwark against the deregulation. And they also, in many respects, they function as a sort of like a deputized posse, and you see this administration, you know, has packed the courts with right wingers. They're going to do so more. The implications of that directly impact individuals' ability to came over in the middle of the broadcast to take the coffees away. The ability of people to go to courts and get redress against corporations. So I think we're going to have an opportunity to talk to more people about that tomorrow and some other specific cases we'll be looking around for. But obviously a big news day too. So we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, talk about the news, and maybe, you know, update on how I'm doing at my lack of luck at the tables. All right, let's start the just a reminder, folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, and your membership will be parlayed at the tables and into maybe, I don't know, TriCaster or something like that.
you know, work on getting a upgrade the video equipment. But all right, quick break, head into the fun half.
Ooh. Ow.
Left is best. Jay, speech issue, if you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.